Good evening. This is NLA Hams Net. We talk about everything NLA-ish and Hamish. This net is held every Wednesday night at 8 p.m. Eastern Time. My name is Terry from Colorado. I am KI0RE if you wish to look me up. And we've been going through the ARRL license, Ham Radio License Manual, third edition, good through June 30th, 2018. I've got us right now on about page 9-3 under response to electrical injury. I think we covered the rest pretty well. I haven't listened to it, so I don't remember exactly, but I'll continue on. I can pick up whatever we need in another session if I need to. So do we have any comments or suggestions, criticisms, whatever you want to say in here right now? From anybody, anywhere. Hearing nothing, I will continue. Please speak up if you want to say anything, and I will stop. If you're shocked into your radio, if you were shocked in your Radio Shack, who would be able to help? And that's kind of that should be a very high priority question. You want to build things so that people can switch the entire shack off if they need to, and flashlight or some kind of automatic light that comes on when that's done, so that people can come out and see you and know that you're all right and then give you some help. You kind of got to work it out with your family and make sure they know where the right switches or breakers are to isolate your ham site in case you're not able to tell them. Also, it mentions that you should get CPR training. I can't emphasize that enough. That's a very good idea. Everybody in your family should have CPR if you're going to be working anywhere near electricity. So, there we go. Oh, got a computer issue here.
Comment, Terry?
Please do.
Yes, this is KC3HVA. Years ago, probably close to 40 years ago, I took the CPR courses, and then I went back and did a refresher here, I don't know, 10, 15 years ago, and it was pretty much totally changed. So I would recommend that everybody that did this at some time in the past, check to make sure that you're current still with the techniques. They're a fair amount different than what they used to do, and so for the best survivability of your co-workers, wives, and loved ones, it would be good to be abreast of what the latest changes are. Over.
Thank you, Jan. That's a very good point. I used to teach it back in the 80s, and then I took a CPR course. I had to have it for an event one time, and it had changed quite a bit. I thought I knew something going in, having taught it before, but you're right. It was changed enough to where I kind of had to learn some new things. So I appreciate that. That's a very good point. AC safe grounding is the next topic. It's at the bottom of page 9-3. The first line says it all. A large part of electrical safety is not to create hazards in the first place. This is why the National Electrical Code and your local building codes were created, to prevent common electrical hazards. And so things have to be to code, in other words. And you need to do it right, which means you need to learn where stuff is, customs and the normal is for your area. In America, the entire American grid system everywhere says that here's some things you do. It's worked out very well. It's hard to plug something in and have a problem. I've seen it happen, but it's hard nowadays because they have thought this all through, and they've installed stuff that makes it hard or difficult, at least, to touch the wrong things or do the wrong things, and you've always got a grounding pin there. don't ever bypass that grounding pin if you can help it. It's the three-prong plug. It's the roundish one that is the ground. Try never to break that off or defeat its use. It's there for your protection.
Comment, please.
Yes, please do.
Yeah, this is KC3HVA again. I know the National Electrical Code mandates that the ground contact be down on the plugs on the wall, and I have never understood that. When I go in someplace and I can't see if it's dark or something, I'm going to plug something in, I can put my finger on the round one so I know where it is and line up the plug right, even in limited light. If it's on the top, if it's on the bottom, I haven't got a prayer. And I know years ago, an electronic technician in the Navy pointed that out to me. He wired his whole house that way, and I've wired everything that way ever since. I'm sure it'll perturb the national code, but I far prefer it any other way. Over.
That's a good point. I like to have the ground up because the one time that I saw something happen was the plug wasn't quite all the way in, but it was making contact, and something narrow kind of fell over. It slid against the wall and then shorted the contacts on the plug. It was just enough room
right
for it to slip there. It was real narrow, and bam!
Yep.
And you're right. If the grounding plug is up, that doesn't
yep
happen.
Mm-hmm.
And I agree with you. So you wired yours with the grounding plug up?
Yep, absolutely.
I think that's a very good idea. And all
yep
the
every plug in my barn, garage, house, sheds, everything, greenhouse, are wired with the ground plug up.
Yes, and I agree with that. And I have not seen anything that says why they do it the other way, except that all of the visuals, the illustrations, like figure 9.1 on page 9-4, they always put the ground plug on the bottom.
Mm-hmm.
And to me, that's dumb. That's
yep,
really dumb.
Exactly.
Okay. Anyway, do use three-wire power cords that connect your chassis equipment to the AC safety ground. Use ground fault interrupt circuits. These are really good if you've ever seen them work. One guy who originally invented it, to show everybody, he put one 220 on one side and the other pole on the other side, and then has somebody, I think it was his daughter, run out and jump in the pool, and it interrupted the electricity in a heartbeat when there was something in the pool. So I'm pretty convinced upon those are good to use. Verify your AC wiring is done properly by using an AC circuit tester. Those are so cheap. You can get one for just a few dollars at Harbor Freight or Lowe's or Home Depot or some other place, any kind of hardware store, and you just plug it in the wall. I have known that somebody wired one socket wrong way down in the basement of this one building I was in, and I went to the second floor, two floors up, and installed a circuit card in a machine and plugged it in. And when I plugged it in, it blew it out, completely blew out the one on the box I was working on and the one downstairs on the server. They never worked again. And it's all because one plug, one receptacle was wired backwards, so the hot and the neutral were swapped. Don't overload single outlets. And if you've ever seen somebody trying to get the power where they want it to be by putting this power strip and that power strip, and then they've got something in every plug, they're probably overloading it. Those are good places to attach watt meters, kilowatt meters, And it's kill a what, not kill a what. And they show you how much energy you're using. And those are very instructive. And you can see how much you're going. Another way is sometimes you can go to the panel and don't touch the circuit breakers right off, but you can run your hand up and you can feel the heat from a particular portion of your breaker box of where things might be taking too much amperage. And so the circuit is overloaded. That's a good way to burn your house down or your shed or whatever you have. If you do need to run new wiring, they have a picture down there. They want you to use a cable sufficiently rated for the expected current load. I don't memorize these charts. I look them up every time. But table 9.2 has a list of copper wire gauges from 6 to 14 and the allowable current on each of those. And I think you need to check something like that. For 14 gauge, it's 20 amps, with a 15 amp breaker. So they make the breaker to where it will go before the wire gets too hot to cause a problem. For 12 gauge, they do the same thing. 25 amps are allowable, and they put a 20 amp breaker there. So just be careful and choose wisely. I do know that some of the people that work at the big box stores know their stuff, because I had one help me when I was helping my son wire a house. And he gave me some code that I didn't know about, and it helped us. And we got it approved and everything eventually, but without having to redo everything. And I appreciate that. Just be careful.
Comment, Terry?
Please do, Jan.
Yeah, and if you suspect that you have one circuit that's drawing an excessive amount of current, you can buy a clamp-on ammeter for, the one I bought years ago is probably $35, and they're made so that you can go to any wire coming out of your fuse box, just the single wire comes out of the breaker. It's just like a clip-on. You push the clip together, it opens up, you slip it over the wire, it closes up, and you can measure the current on that particular wire coming out of that breaker. And a lot of times some people, if they have outside wiring, like I've got wires going to my shop, I had a yard light out there, it's about 100 feet from the house. And for convenience, I wired it with a three-way switch so I could turn it off in the house or the shop. Then the first year, got hit by lightning and fried the wire all the way back to the house. But if you want to, if you don't have anything that drastic, so you really have to pay attention, you probably should check at least once a year any underground cabling going anywhere else to make sure it doesn't have parasitic loss. They get some wiring that the insulation goes bad. It's underground. You get a lot of rain. It gets wet. It conducts electricity pretty well. My next-door neighbor got a $200 electric bill from the wire running from the house to his garage about 30 feet away. Because doesn't short out enough to blow the breaker, but it runs the current way up, and it runs all the time, whether or not you have anything turned on, because it just goes out to wherever this defect in the wiring is, and then has a load there due to the ground and the water, and then it comes back to the circuit box. And so you can get a really big bill if you suspect that your bill has gone up suddenly. I would check that. And it's different than the watt meter, which you just plug in the AC line and then plug things into it. You can go down to the box and clip right over the wire that powers that circuit. Over.
Yeah, you do have to, in that case, take off the front panel of the breaker box to access those
right.
Wires. Getting very dangerous, and don't mind, hams probably know what they're doing, but be careful. Have somebody show you the first time, and you'll be safe. But that is a good idea. You can get a Harbor Freight meter for about $30, $25, $30, mm-hmm. That has that built in. just as what Jan's talking about. Also, I can relate. Last year about this time, I was living in a different house, and anytime somebody turned the microwave on, my computer would almost reboot. Luckily, I had a uninterruptible power supply on there, so I was generating battery AC through an inverter. But I got to looking, the lights would dim sometimes, so I got to looking and I measured. Instead of putting out 120 volts, when you turned on the microwave, it went down to 99 volts. Or it went up to 145. So it depended upon what you were running as to what was happening. And the landlord got somebody out there, and it was actually a break, or a break and a grounding, probably failure of insulation of the neutral to ground. And they finally got it fixed, but the landlord was none too happy because he really had to tear up the yard to cut a trench so that they could rewire that from the electric company all the way back to the house again. They had to move a few things, so that was very interesting. It's all in what you do, and there's been enough experience across the U.S. over the last 50 years that they've taken care of a lot of these things. If you just follow what those what the codes tell you to and what the licensed people will tell you, you don't have to have them, but you need to know the same thing that they know so that you can do it safely. Okay, anybody else? A home safety ground is adequate to control shock hazards for 60 hertz AC power systems. At radio frequencies, though, the safety ground wiring usually acts more like an antenna than a ground, as we discussed in the amateur radio equipment chapter. The only safety hazard that remains from poor RF grounding are RF burns. They're a result of a contact with the hotspot, and usually, not always, but many times, the frequency is high enough to where it just moves across your skin, and it hurts like the dickens, and it makes a little burn, but there's no lasting problems. Bonding your equipment together with wire or strap keeps all the radio equipment the same RF voltage. That's mostly true. What you got to do is put a strap to the ground so you got a nice, easy path to ground, and then have one connection for them all that goes to your actual ground. If you try to ground them twice and run to another ground across the other side of the house just so you got them covered, you create eddy currents. And you may create a current ground path that wasn't there if you hadn't made the second connection. So always take it to one reliable ground. Let's see. I would like to go to the lightning chapter. It's the bottom page 9-4. And lightning is one of those things where, oh, my word, it will do so many things that you would never think it would do. Like the normal separation of contacts in a regular switch, like a light switch, it'll jump that in a heartbeat. And the ones in radios, they're so close together, it'll jump those even easier. So when lightning comes, you've got a thunderstorm in the area or something like that, really good idea to unplug everything and kind of get it away from lightning. I've even heard of people who were taking a shower, and because they were taking a shower, there's lightning in the area, they didn't have a pipe grounded right. and the lightning came down and hit a pipe. Maybe it was plastic pipe. And it hit the metal part and went into the flow and went through the person down to the drain they were standing on. Just be careful. This also talks about your antennas, your masts, your everywhere. Antenna mounts should be grounded according to your local building codes. This is done at the base, or in case of roof mounts, through a large diameter wire to a ground rod. And I've got some opinions about how to drive ground rods. The simplest one is don't use a single solid rod. That's an expensive rod if it's made of copper. But you can do a copper pipe, and what you do is you pour water down the hole, but you know, get it into the ground a little ways, then pour water down it and wait a few minutes. And then go back out, pound it down a little, and put some more water in it. You'd be amazed at how deep you can get it to go and how easily it goes in. It's a lot easier than pounding that copper rod down into the ground, which I've done. Oh.
Comment?
And then they also talk about avoiding sharp bends. Why do you think they say to avoid sharp bends? Anybody got any ideas?
Radiation off the end.
Yeah, radiation off the end. Anytime you make a sharp bend, it's 9 degrees or so from the way the wire's been traveling. If you make gentle bends, it's not so bad. But when anytime you make a 90-degree bend, you've just created an antenna, and that's a radiator. And so it doesn't do real well. You don't want that to happen, because if it's on your grounding, then the electricity is going to try and jump at the bend because it doesn't like to go around sharp bends. That's the easy way to say it, and that's not technical. And I can be challenged on that one, but that's the way it seems to act. It mentions lightning arresters. Those do work pretty well. And unplugging things, disconnecting things, and then go figure out what your insurance really is preventing, what they're insuring against, because you might not have insurance from what you think you have. And you would definitely want to get that straight. Yes?
This is KC3HVA again. This is maybe a little off topic, but you were talking about all the ways lightning can do things. And our regular landlines make huge antennas. And if they get hit by lightning, that travels right down the line. It likes wires. And there is a person, I don't know if you've ever heard of Daniel Brinkley, who was talking on the telephone, landline, and a storm came up, and boom, there was a flash of lightning. And it went down the wire, went through his body, and they hauled him off to the hospital. He was dead for 30 to 45 minutes, and he came back. When they went back and looked, he had so much current run through his body that there were holes through the carpet where his heels were and where the nails in his shoes were. And he was pretty much totally destroyed for about 9 months. He couldn't stand light. He wore a welding helmet with the dark lenses. Because he couldn't stand the light, and his recuperation was, I don't know, a year and a half before he could get up and walk around much. So don't get on the phone, landline anyway, when there's a lightning storm. There's another area you can get hit. Over.
Oh, very good. We're talking about landlines there. Not quite as bad with cell phones and things like that sort. If it's got a wire and it's going into your wall, there's a chance all that can happen. So be aware. Forearmed is forewarned. And the last paragraph says, regardless of how much protection you install on your antenna system, operating during a thunderstorm is a bad idea. Even a nearby strike can create voltage surge of thousands of volts in a power or phone line, causing equipment damage or setting the house on fire? Yes, it can. Next one is a similar topic, but totally different. And that is 9.2 RF exposure. Now, you kind of hinted at this in the past, and you kind of got to be aware of what you're radiating and how strong it is. There's a lot of discussions in recent years whether there are health and safety hazards from exposure to electromagnetic radiation, which they define here as EMR. They abbreviate it that way. Many studies have been done at both power line frequencies, 50 and 60 hertz, and RF, both shortwave and mobile frequencies. No link has been established between exposure to low-level EMR, electromagnetic radiation, and health risks, including those frequencies used by amateurs. And I wanted to temper that a little bit. There have been studies that found some kind of connection, and we just get away from it, and you don't hear a lot about it because there's a lot of people that want to ensure that they can still make their microwaves or the radios or whatever. It's still not good to have anything, regardless of how strong it is. And if you make it strong enough to reach a cell tower a mile away, well, think what that's doing going through your head to get there. Not the best idea. And you just need to be aware of that. I'm not saying anybody's violating anything. I don't want to get sued. But it's kind of still a question out there. And anybody who's read Zap, the Zapping of America, I think it's what it's called, by Brodeur, Paul Brodeur, he may convince you that you need to pay attention to what you're doing. There's a lot of hams that they won't talk on a handy talkie unless they can raise it up well above their head and talk on a speaker mic. And I've mentioned that before also. Both very good ideas. RF radiation is not the same as ionizing radiation from radioactivity because the energy in signals at RF frequencies is far too low to cause an electron to leave an atom ionized. That's what ionized means. It knocks off. The energy is absorbed by an electron, and an electron goes whizzing out of its orbit and is no longer attached to that atom. That's what ionizing radiation is. At these relatively low frequencies, RF energy is non-ionizing radiation. Nevertheless, even the absence of evidence that RF fields pose a health risk, it is prudent to avoid unnecessary exposure to high levels of RF. The FCC regulations, and this is the part where we're starting to get into the regulations that they've done to try and make it a little safer. Are they 100% right? I'm not entirely convinced. Should you be doing it that way? Yeah, as a precaution. And I think it's a good idea to do the things they said and follow the FCC regulations. The FCC regulations set limits on the maximum permissible exposure, MPE, from radio transmitters of any sort. To abide by these rules without requiring expensive testing, hams are expected to evaluate their stations to see if their operation has the potential to exceed MPE levels. The evaluation process is covered later in this section. DARRL's RF Exposure and You contains a detailed treatment of exposure rules and safety techniques. And what they're saying is that when you apply for your license, there's a little comment on there that says, I will ensure that I operate my station within the FCC safety regulations for MPE or something along that line. And yet you have to be careful that you or at least close to that, or the FCC will shut you down for not having a survey on your property and your standard radio. Now, what are we talking about? Are we talking about the 5-watt handheld in your hand that you're holding up and talking on the speaker mic? No, that's not what we're really talking about. What we're talking about is the 100-watt multi-band super-duper base station that's sitting in your ham shack and the radio antenna that's going up, or maybe you're using different antennas. I had 3 separate external antennas, an inverted V attached to the back wall of my house, a dipole, 40-meter dipole that was at about 120 degrees, attached to 2 different trees that were convenient on the roof of my house. And then I had a UHF VHF antenna sticking straight up, a vertical antenna. Now, the vertical one, nobody's really bothering that because it's at the peak of my roof, and it was well above everybody, and it had a ground plane on it, so not much was coming down. But the other two, they were within an area that if somebody was in my backyard, they might be getting too much. Well, I didn't transmit a whole lot, so I would check the backyard, and I would run everybody out of there if I wanted to transmit or wait until they were back in the house. Then I would check it routinely as I was transmitting. But they go into more detail inside the regulations. RF energy can also cause injury to the human body if the combination of frequency and power causes excessive energy to be absorbed. We had a little thing that we used to set antennas up with in one of my prior lives in the Air Force, and we had to rope it off so nobody went back there, because it could eat you up, and it was powerful enough to do so. Anyway.
Comment again, please?
Yes, please do.
I'm sorry to keep interrupting you, but you say these things that bring to mind other things. For example, when you talk about walking around with your walkie-talkie with the antenna held up in the air. When I first started working many years ago, I had a fellow that was kind of an interesting guy. He was a lapidary kind of gem kind of guy, collected stones. And he went out west and was, you know, looking for stones. And he liked to fish, so he had a fishing rod. And in those days, regular fishing rods weren't these fancy fiberglass things. They were just old steel rods. And thunderstorm came up. And he was holding his pole vertically, and I guess he was running to get out of the storm, and he got hit by lightning and was killed. That was about a month after he retired. So get inside and don't use your walkie-talkie in the storm. Another friend of mine who was in the Navy got stationed at Argentia, Newfoundland on the Dew Line. I know some of you know this story. But on a Dew Line, those radars are high-powered devices, and you can't see RF energy, and they didn't have any, this is 1960s, I guess, didn't have an easy way to measure radiation levels, so all ETs working there, and I don't mean extraterrestrials, I mean electronic technicians, would stick a few neon bulbs in their hat. And if you're walking around doing things and you look over at your buddy and his hat's lighting up, they'd run over and kill the transmitter immediately because something had happened and they were getting stray energy in the control room or in where the power amplifiers were. So that makes just a plain old NE2D neon bulb makes a real good indicator that there's high-frequency RF energy drifting around. Over.
Excellent point, Jan, once again. And I appreciate you making comments. I think that's wonderful that you have this experience that you can contribute. And I want to hear everything that you think of that you want to say. That is a very good idea. If you hold a large fluorescent tube up a little bit underneath these high power lines, lots of times they'll light up, and that just shows you what the field is. And, you know, that kind of makes the explanation in here a little more personable, because what we're talking about is any antenna, anything that's carrying electricity has an electronic field around it. And the electronic field is proportional to the amount of electricity, the amperage, that's flowing through it. And it also has a characteristic frequency. 50 and 60 megahertz seems to be pretty safe. We've successfully installed it in billions of homes worldwide with no understandable linkage to any kind of effect in the body, which there are two. One is RF energy has a thermal effect, which is heating, and it also has a biological or athermal effect. And now the athermal effects haven't been demonstrated. It just passes on through the body. But the heating does affect you, and it can burn inside. So it can go down a little bit and go through your muscle or the outside of your muscle next to your bone. And that's hard to heal, and it hurts like the dickens, and it takes a long time for the body to heal. But back to the thing. Yeah, go, please do that.
And that's an excellent point, Terry. This friend of mine who worked on a new line said they had problems initially because people were working out around it, and I don't know if they had guards around it or what, they were on duty. They found that they went over under the antenna by the amplifiers and stuff, they felt warmer. So they'd go over there to get warm, and they were basically cooking themselves, like jumping in their microwave oven, till they found out what they were doing and what was going on, and then they put a quick stop to that. But I imagine there were a number of people who were fairly severely injured before they finally figured out what was causing their problems, because it wouldn't be, you know, you're out in fall weather gear and bitter cold. Hey, it's a little warmer over here. You're out of the wind behind the building, and you're getting toasted.
Yeah, and it's not toasted on the outside. It's toasted on the inside.
Right.
Okay. Well, that's what they're talking about. You don't want people getting toasted unawares. So sometimes at field-based sites, you'll see that the antennas are 100, 150 feet away from where your operating tent is. Sometimes they're closer because you can't help it. But there is a specific distance. Radio frequency waves are very similar to light. There's an inverse square law. And so what they try to do is they want to ensure that people are not exposed to high-strength fields in one of two ways, preventing access to locations where strong fields are present and making sure strong fields are not created in or directed to areas where people might be present. And then it goes on to about, you know, taking a look at this and looking at that. Heating as a result of exposure to RF fields is caused by the body absorbing RF energy. So it warms things up. The molecules inside your body warm up physically because the RF energy is going through your body. Then it starts to talk about power density on page 9-6. And now we're getting to the heart of the problem. The intensity of an RF field is called power density. Power density is the amount of energy per unit area. The most common way of stating power density is in milliwatts per square centimeter. And they've got the terms there. It's a little m, a big W, a slash, and then square centimeter squared. The power density of an RF field is the highest near antennas. It suddenly got dark in here. That's what's interesting. Where was I? There was something around antenna to the same degree. What they're doing is they're saying that there's a close field and a little bit further field. And if they're in the further field, People can be in that for about 30 minutes and they don't see, and I know what happened. Okay. They can be in that area, but it's going to take a while for them to really feel or be threatened by the exposure in that area. But the near field is maybe 20, 30 feet right around the antenna, and it varies based upon there's a what's called a maximum permissible exposure, MPE limits, and there's a chart on page 9-7 that shows some of that. And it varies by frequency, and it varies by power and how close you are. And they label the two controlled exposure and uncontrolled exposure. And there's a chart on page 9-6, figure 9.2, about the bandwidths and how controlled you're allowed a little bit more because you rope that off and you don't let people in there very much. If somebody needs to go check the antenna, that's great. They walk in there, check it. Even if you're transmitting, it ain't going to hurt you because it has it's low enough, the field is low enough, that it's not going to hurt that person for that amount of time. Now, I'm going to start here on power density next week and exposure limits and get into a little more about it. Good reading. I know it's hard sometimes, but you have to do this. And check your numbers so that you can know that you're not irradiating people you shouldn't and that the energy you're imparting to their bodies is not going to hurt them. All right, anybody want to say anything else before we log off here?
Interesting session.
Safety gets tough, and you got to know your stuff. I do want to say one anecdote. I was at the NTIS, which is the old NIST, NIST, that's what it is, NIST. Anyway, it's the old site in Boulder where they have the clocks that actually run WWV. And WWV, you can hear spread across the HF band, and the idea is that if one band doesn't work, you can switch to another band that will work. And the scientist was very intimately familiar with that, and he said, we finally have, and he quoted the number, and I never did go back and ask him again, but he's just for saying, we now have 3 milliwatts per square centimeter of, and I think it's per meter, square meter at the time, signal, which means now all these devices that pick up the time automatically, and your clock on the wall stays synced to WWV automatically, those will work now because they've managed to get the antenna array around the United States set so that that would work. And it was just interesting to hear that. I had not thought about how they get that done until that point. And the clocks that would automatically adjust to WWV were very rare at that time. Now they're almost in any fancy clock that you buy, maybe a digital clock, and it syncs up to WWV at any time and all the time. And you have the correct time all the time on your clock. So this has been the NLA Hamsnet. My name is Terry.
Question.
I'm KI0RE. Look it up if you like. This net is about ham radio and the NLA. Any topics are on the table if they fall into those two categories. This net is held every Wednesday night at 6 p.m. for me, but 8 p.m. Eastern time. And we just have a good time, and anybody's welcome to contribute at any time. Thank you all very much for participating, and especially you, Jan, for all the comments. I really appreciate they add value to these conference calls. And I hope everybody joins us once again next Wednesday at 8 p.m. Eastern time. The net is now closed.